Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
What's up, everyone, and welcome to another special episode of IndiePod, where we get to talk to the people behind some of our favorite indie games. Now, today is another interesting episode because we don't have a developer today. We actually instead have Michael Brown, the CEO of Vicarious PR. Thanks for joining, Mike.
You're most welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
Can I call you Mike? I know I did that on the spot, but...
It really does not matter at all.
Okay. I'm the same way. My name is Joshua, but a lot of people, they're like, Joshua, and you know, whatever you're feeling, right?
Yeah, I'm a laid back kind of guy, so it's not a problem.
Okay. Glad to hear. All right. Well, I'm glad you could make it because honestly, the PR world, like, I don't know a lot about it. It's not my forte, really. And after doing, you know, these interviews for about 2 years now, it's interesting that I haven't had as many individuals come on in kind of your shoes, which is more of like, you know, the journalistic side of things and the marketing side of things. Mm-hmm. So I'm interested to talk about, you know, your background as well as just the company. But I always like to kick these off with the people themselves. So Mike, tell me a little bit just about yourself. You know, who the heck are you?
Sure. So, I got my start in the games industry originally, doing a combination of YouTube videos back in the day where I reviewed games, and I did a couple of interviews with developers and things like that. And then I freelanced as a games journalist for several sites back in the UK before I made the horrible transition to the US. And then after doing that for a little while, really, like, being on the journalist side, you know, as you can imagine, I received a lot of PR pitches from, you know, PR professionals across the mm-hmm. industry and developer emails and things like that. And I looked at a lot of them and I was like, oh, I could do that. I could do that much better. I'm a firm believer is if you think you can do something better, then you should just go do it. So I took the plunge. With a journalist friend of mine, we set up Vicarious, and 5 years later, here we are doing. We do everything from a cross between solo indie dev stuff to AAA games and the wide spectrum in between.
Yeah, that's awesome to hear. What was it about? You know, you said you were seeing these emails, you were getting this communication from these different companies, and you thought, I could do that. But what was it that interests you about the PR side of things?
I think there's a combination of things, right? So I think the first and foremost is that I always wanted to work in games, mm-hmm. But having absolutely no talent whatsoever when it comes to either being an artist or being a programmer, it kind of limited my options a little bit. And so I was like, okay, so you've got no talent in any of those areas. What can you do? And then I thought, well, you know, I write fairly well, and mm-hmm. I know how to talk about a game and how to talk about a game and can identify a good game from a bad game. Right. And so I kind of put that into play and looked at, you know, what would be fun. And I thought it would be really fun to work in the marketing field and figuring out like what gets people excited about games, you know, the challenges that come with taking like an unknown indie developer on their first title and making them a hit, like all the different variables that go into that. And then on top of that, you know, when I was receiving a lot of like PR pitches and indie dev emails asking me to check out their game, it used to be like soul destroying. I mean, I used to get a couple hundred emails a day.
Yeah.
And of those, I mean, they were very, very rarely personalized. Many of them didn't have my name in them. So it wasn't like, hey, Michael, can you take a look at this? I really love your work. It was more like, a copy and paste mass mm-hmm. MailChimp send email. And oftentimes the send outs weren't even researched to the point where, because I used to work for a lot of PC only sites. And I would get like mobile game pitches like all the time. And it's like, you're not even attempting to do any kind of legwork. And so when we started Vicarious, what my first and foremost goal was to make sure that we did it in a really holistic and targeted way, so that one, you're respecting the journalist's time in terms of knowing who they are, actually spending the time to write them, or, you know, write them a personalized email or call them. And you know that this game is going to be something that they're actually interested in based on what they've covered and liked in the past. But also, right, I think it does a service to developers who spend all this time making this game and putting all their love and effort into something. And you want to give that game the best chance for success that it can have. And I think the only way to do that is to really target and make sure that you're doing it in a holistic way, so that it reaches the people that are going to be most interested in it, and as well as ultimately the target audience, and making sure that, players know about it as well.
Right. Yeah, I definitely think that makes sense. And I want to dive a little bit deeper into that area. But before I do, I did have one question that I wanted to cover, which is really kind of how this all got started, right? Because I think it is interesting. It's one thing to say, like, I could probably do this better, right? Or I could do this in a way that I think will help other developers and will be more impactful. But that sentiment, and then also on the flip side, actually doing it and starting your own company and creating this whole entire thing, that's like, I don't even know where I would start, right? Like, what was that beginning story for you? Like, how did you actually create what is now Vicarious PR?
I mean, to be honest, it's kind of an odd story, right? Like, you hear about stories in terms of like people just bootstrap it, and we mm-hmm. very much did. I mean, literally with about $200, right? Like, we bought, a domain name, we set up a website, we registered the business, we put the website live, mm-hmm. and then it was really much of a very traditional hustle and grind kind of thing, where I was on LinkedIn, I was on Twitter, I was like hitting up developers saying, hey, do you guys need PR? Do you need help with marketing? And very much just trying to get our name out there, which is, it's very difficult to do, especially in an industry that's been established, and there's some, amazing and well-established PR companies and marketing agencies out there. And it's very much what developers go through, right? When you set right. up your first business, and you've got you're making it, like, say you're making an RPG, and there's tons of great RPGs out there, and it's like, okay, well, how do I make this work, and how do I get people interested in me? And so I would say it was very much a combination of, if I'm honest, it was a combination of hard work and a little bit of luck. And yeah, I think you'd be surprised how much luck plays into a lot of people's success. It's, kind of right place, right time. Someone's willing to take a chance on you. Somebody sees something there that they're willing to say yes to. And very much, we were very lucky enough to get our first client very, very quickly. And that allowed us to work on a couple of projects that really then just kind of turned a little bit of into a snowball. And then we kind of grew as a company pretty much about 150% year on year, and have continued to do that. So
that's impressive.
Don't underestimate the value of luck.
It's something that I hear a lot when talking to a number of people, especially those who have kind of made it, to a degree, and they're in a better place when it comes to, yes, I have a successful game out, or yes, we have, a wide audience that are consuming our product. It is something where you have to be good at what you do, but also just in the right place in a lot of sense.
Yeah. I mean, all you can do, regardless of whether you're making a game or setting up a business or whatever it is, that the only thing that you can do is do the best that you can, right? You do everything that you can to try and make it successful, but there is always that little bit of element at the end where you, at some point, no matter how hard you prepare, no matter what you do to differentiate yourself, no matter what problems you solve and fix with your product, ultimately you've got to roll the dice at the end. And and sometimes, I mean, I'm very much a firm believer in I'm a big Star Trek fan, and there's a great Captain Picard quote that says, it's possible to make no errors and still fail,
right?
And that's there's never been a truer statement, especially in video games, where I've seen some amazing games just fall flat for no other reason than that variable of people just didn't pick it up. because right. there was nothing, you know, nothing objectively wrong with anything that the developers did or anything. So it's very much true. I mean, and sometimes it just happens like that. I mean, I know many developers who've made 5-6 games, and then on the 7th game, when they're about to call it quits and leave the industry, and they've had enough of trying and failing, they make it big. And
right.
and if and you know, when you ask them like, what was it about that 7th time, and they look at you kind of no idea.
Like, well, it was just the one that stuck. I definitely understand it, but a lot of, you know, that sentiment for getting that audience and getting the word out there, right? That's a lot of what you as Vicarious PR is really doing and trying to avoid situations like that, right? So what kind of offerings or what kind of way are you trying to avoid situations like that, you know, game 1 through 6?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. There's a couple of things that we do. I mean, we like to work with developers as early as possible, because oftentimes developers who are making indie games, and this is very kind of indie specific, because you tend to find that larger companies understand the value of marketing and PR from an early stage. So
right.
they invest more in it. But when you're, you know, when you're a one man team or a small team, you don't have the time nor the resources to be able to do that. And so we work from a concept stage sometimes, where we develop the branding, we develop like the logo and the key visuals and the art and things like that, and help them really form the messaging of any given game. Yeah. And then later down the line, you know, we're doing things like outreaching to press, we're talking to influencers and content creators, we're talking, you know, we do social media content and create videos and try and make stuff go viral and try and get eyeballs on the product that way. We dip our toes into advertising and sponsored content as well. And I try to avoid, as a general rule, like template campaigns, because it's very easy to go, well, this is another game, and so, you know, I'll put 2 press releases out, I'll do a couple of emails, I'll get some influencers on it, and, you know, it'll work or it won't. We try to develop our campaigns built around the game itself, whether that's right. the theme of the game, whether it's a specific mechanic in the game. We try and build our campaigns around that so that it feels unique, and it opens the doorway to a little bit more creativity in terms of doing something a little bit different. So for example, like maybe doing one of the things that I loved Creative Assembly did was when they released Total War 3 Kingdoms, they hired a YouTuber who was a YouTuber who focused on cartoon history. And so mm-hmm. they would animate these little funny short videos that would explain in a funny way something, you know, a specific historical period. And so they hired them to help people understand the context of the game. And so doing little things like that, where you're not doing the traditional, like, have, you know, XY YouTuber play the game on stream for 2 hours, is, I think those are the campaigns that are most fun for me.
Yeah, yeah. So you gotta think outside of the box, because otherwise everything just kind of sticks the same, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, it makes sense. But how do you approach that? Because I think obviously you have to be creative in that lens, and each project is going to be a little bit different when it comes to like how much involvement is required. And I guess where my question is really coming to is like, how do you assess that, especially at the very beginning when you're working with a company? And is there any, like, you know, like thinking about the major differences between indie versus triple A in regards to, like, obviously from a funding or level of importance or an awareness perspective, but what are those major differences in how you're assessing this company on what is really required?
There's a couple of different things within that. Like, the first and foremost, I mean, ultimately everything comes down to the game itself, right? I mean, yeah. no amount of marketing or PR is going to shine a turd to something shiny, right? It's never going to happen.
Right.
So if you've got a bad product, then it doesn't matter what you do, you've got a bad product, and that's just the end of it. Yeah. So it really comes down to
have you had to turn down people of being like, I'm sorry, we're just not going to help you?
Yeah, we do it quite regularly.
Okay.
It's not an uncommon thing, because you've got you've got everybody who, from commercially successful developers to 17-year-olds who want to build their first game.
Right.
And, you know, and so we get pitched a lot of stuff and we turn down a lot of stuff because, one, it's, you know, it does a disservice to us and our brand to promote something that we know to be not good.
Right.
And I don't think it, you know, and journalists and the people that we're trying to pitch the game to don't appreciate it either. Right. So it just damages those relationships in the end as well.
Yeah.
So it's just not worth it. But yeah, I mean, I think ultimately it does come down to the game and everything is built around the game. So, you know, I think the only real difference, well, there's, I mean, there are multiple differences, but the biggest difference is between an indie game and a AAA game is ultimately budget. And that there are, you know, and because ultimately you've got a situation where a AAA developer is going to be able to do a lot more things because they have the resources and the war chest to be able to do those things. Whereas an indie has got to pick and choose their battles wisely. We kind of make that assessment on the game, what the budget is, and then also what we're trying to achieve. Because, you know, from an outside perspective, it might be easy to look at it and go, well, game developers just want to be successful and sell lots of games. But actually, there are many cases where developers aren't looking for just commercial success. Mm-hmm. They might be looking to build up a brand, and they might be thinking long term and saying, well, we know this game is not going to sell a million copies, but what we're looking to do is, you know, leave a good taste in players' mouths and start to build up a community over several games so that we can eventually get to that stage. So there's, you know, there's lots of different the criteria that are involved in it, and so that's why it's very much a case-by-case basis, because every company is different, every game is different, and so you really have to kind of pull all the different elements together and then build your plan after that.
Yeah. And looking at the breakdown of those projects that you've worked on, so I was looking through some of the just games that you've been a part of specifically, and this is less of a question and just more of me kind of a personal thank you, because you've helped out in one way or another. I don't know exactly what you did, but Gunfire Reborn is one mm-hmm. of my favorite games. I've played way too much of it. and so this is just a way for me to gush about it for a second and say thank you.
No, it's fine. Yeah, no, we were actually the PR team responsible for the original early access launch for that game.
Nice.
So yeah, I love that game. It's great.
I'm glad to hear it, because it definitely has stuck with my friends. But that being said, I mentioned, you know, I don't know all the ins and outs that come into what exactly you might and might not do, depending on, you know, there's a lot of these different scenarios, these variables that a company or a game is going to need, right? But you mentioned that sometimes you have to turn these down, right? What is the main avenue of you getting these clients per se, right? Is this a lot of would you say your basis is more people reaching out to you, you reaching out to them? I assume it obviously probably started one way versus another in the early stages. Sure. But what's your normal go-to plan when people show up? Because I'm also thinking about this, you know, you only have so many people on your team, right? I'm sure there's mm-hmm. a good amount of, you know, what's your prioritization as well?
Yeah, so the way that we do it, we in terms of the amount of campaigns that we have ongoing, we cap it so that we're never in a situation where we're overstretched in terms of manpower, and that way our clients can, and the games that we're working on, they can feel confident in the fact that we're giving them the attention that they need.
Right.
And then in terms of how we get clients, it's a bit of both, to be honest. I mean, you know, obviously we do, you know, as the company's grown and is more well known for some of the campaigns that we've done over the years, people do come to us, but vice versa. And you might get the occasional developer talking, you know, because the industry is somewhat insular in that way. So you might get developers talking to another developer and then recommending us because they've used us in the past.
Right.
So there's a lot of recommendations that do come out of it. But, you know, if I see a cool game on Steam, I will literally hit up my business development manager and I'll be like, get me a meeting with those people. I need to talk about that game. Because if I say something that excites me and then I think that I can do well with it, right? Like for me, it's a win-win because if I can get them as a client, one, I get to work on a cool game that I think looks awesome. And two, I know I, the team has the talent and the ability to make it successful for them. So I'm totally not ashamed to cold email somebody and say, let me work on this.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're right though, because it benefits a lot of parties, especially like if you want to just see a game come to fruition and you think it's really cool, you're going to be passionate about it. You're going to want to tell other people about it. It just becomes, less of what people think of as quote unquote a job versus you just trying to promote something that you think looks really cool and people need to know about, right?
Yeah, I mean, it helps the team. I mean, from any kind of management level, you ultimately in an ideal world, you have projects that your team can really get excited by, because if they're excited mm-hmm. by something and passionate about something, then their work and the level of effort that they put in is inherently going to be greater than something that's forced upon them. So, we try and get games that, we as gamers are excited by and have fun with. And sometimes we don't get them all, we're working on that.
Right. I mean, yeah, every year you'll get bigger and bigger, right? That's the plan. But I do want to ask what your favorite project is that you've worked on so far.
Oh, favorite project. There's so many. I mean, there's lots of different projects I like for different reasons. I think I really enjoyed working on Before We Leave, which was an indie city builder.
Mm-hmm.
Cause that really came out of nowhere and we made that very successful. And it was one of the first games we ever did after the Epic Store had just launched. And nice. So we didn't know exactly how that was going to land, because obviously at the time when Epic announced their store, there was a lot of pushback from Steam right. fanboys. And so we were like, is this going to, and because it was an Epic exclusive, we were like, is this going to sell? It did very, very well. And so I was very pleased with that. And I was really pleased for the developers because they're a wonderful team from Australia. I've really enjoyed my work on, and this is less indie, but I've really enjoyed the work that I've done on Dead by Daylight.
Mm-hmm.
Dead by Daylight's a massive game and it was a real pleasure to work on that. And we've worked on that now for a number of years. Yeah. So that was a nice little career highlight. But funnily enough, in recent years, I've actually really, like, we've done a couple of remasters and re-releases. So it's been really nice and very, very nostalgic to work on some games like Kingdom Under Fire and Baldur's mm-hmm. Gate Dark Alliance, cool. I've been able to work on games that I played when I was young. So that's always been a nice touch.
Yeah. And it goes right back into what we were talking about of being able to easily get on board with it because you're clearly passionate about it, right? You want this to go well because you have that nostalgia factor. You have that, I loved this game before and now it's a new way for other generations to continue that.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, it's so much fun to work on games that you really enjoy playing, and and sometimes, that's not always the case in the industry, especially when you're a developer, but if you can find something that you enjoy playing at the end of the day as well as during the day, then, you're a win-win.
Yeah, I can't agree more. Let's talk a little bit about what happens when you're actually working with them, right? Because you mentioned a couple of things as far as like what you offer, but like there's a couple in here while I was looking through your website that I thought were interesting, which was specifically things like the influencer side of things, as well as mm-hmm. like crisis communication. Can you elaborate a little bit more about like those pieces as well as, what Vicarious is really offering?
Sure. So, I mean, for influencers, we do what we call earned outreach, which is essentially very similar to like reaching out to press, where we just, we build a campaign where we're trying to contact YouTubers and Twitch streamers and get them interested and excited about the game. And then with the hopes that they'll eventually, play the game and record it and play it on their channels and stuff like that.
Right.
We also do paid campaigns where we're doing sponsorships We try to avoid doing like boring sponsorships. We try to do stuff that's fun for everybody involved, and it doesn't feel like a like an ad, so to say. Like, it's more entertainment, but like raising the awareness of the game at the same time. And then for crisis communications, we do help companies who, and we're pretty selective about this, but we do help some companies who have either through their own fault or no fault of their own, fallen into getting bad press. And or sometimes it's not even bad press. It might just be a community issue. Like they've neglected their community in some form or another, and so the community's turned on them. And so we, you know, we try and help them, show them a path to fixing that situation.
Yeah, yeah. I want to talk a little bit about that, just because that's a really tough area, right? You know, that's something that a lot of people, when they're in that negative space, can just kind of dig themselves there into their own grave, right? What, you know, where did you find that type of knowledge or that expertise? And kind of how does that look for some of these companies as far as like Vicarious stepping in?
So in terms of finding the knowledge, it was a lot of legwork and research and seminars and conferences, and then also a little bit of adapting traditional crisis communications to the games industry, because it's very different than, you know, something like the corporate world or anything like that. Right. And then on top of that, you know, it was really in terms of how it looks when we come in, it's very, very situational. It very much depends on our purview. It depends on what the actual crisis situation is. It depends on the company that working for. It depends on their company culture. It depends on, you know, all those type of things, because sometimes, I mean, I've turned down a company for crisis communications because I felt that I couldn't trust the leadership behind it.
Wow.
So because if I don't believe in the company or I don't believe in the people and what they're trying to do, then it's very, very hard for me to fix that, because ultimately it's a problem that can't be fixed, because it's a cultural issue. And so any advice that I give is going to go and fall on deaf ears. Right. And so, yeah, I mean, it's very, very situational. It depends entirely on if we think we can fix the situation or not. And we have to be able to trust that the company is going to actually listen to our advice, and make changes both internal and external, that, and they're actually going to follow through with the plan to actually make that situation better. Because I get paid at the end of the day either way, but you know, success stories are what I want. And so if I don't feel confident that a developer is going to follow through, then we probably won't even take it on in the first place.
Yeah. I mean, I think that makes sense. It goes right back to that whole, you have to, respect your own brand when you're working on these projects, right? It's, you're not only bringing up or promoting these companies every time you work with someone, you're essentially putting yourself out there and saying, you know, Vicarious is a part of this, right? So anything that goes negative is obviously going to have some element of you and your team being involved.
Yeah, I mean, very much. I mean, there are certain degrees of separation, because you are an external agency, and people tend to understand that you're an external agency.
Of course.
I think there is inherently bias and perception issues, regardless of whether you're an external agency or not. And I think, you know, especially on some, if the crisis situation in particular is a moral issue or you know, something like that, then I think it's important to live by your own code and be able to stand up and say, yeah, I'm not going to do that, no matter how much money you're offering me.
Yeah. I think it makes sense. I have one final question that I love to ask anyone who comes on. Usually this is more specific to like people who are developing games and kind of insights into what can help those getting into the field. But I'd love to hear some advice from your side of things, because I think it is very interesting going in from this journalistic perspective to running your own PR company. You know, let's take the perspective of looking back at when you first started, when you had first said like, you know what, I can do this, I can do this better, and like, let's start our own company with the other co-founder, what would you say now if you had the same knowledge that you do today, as far as, you know, like advice or things that would have helped you or things that did help you that you did that kind of paved the way for yourself?
I don't know. I think the biggest advice that I would give to like a developer who's starting their own game before they do anything really is to first figure out what type of game they actually want to make, because in my mind, there's two different types of games. There's games that indies make because they're passionate about it and they want to make it for them and they just want that thing to exist. Right. But then there's also, you know, games for commercial success where you're trying to make a commercial viable product, and thus you have to make decisions and choices based on your audience's preference, right? Because those mm-hmm. two are very, very different things, because ultimately it fundamentally changes the entire game design.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, spending a good amount of time at that starting period figuring out who your target audience is in terms of who are the players we want to play this game, what are they going to like, what should I, you know, because that's going to really inform your game design throughout, because there's not enough people in the industry who think about things from a gamer's perspective, right? Like, they don't put themselves, and they really need to do like thought exercises where you put yourself in you know, standard gamer's shoes and be like, okay, I'm a 35-year-old guy. I love turn-based RPGs and first-person shooters. What is it, the things that I like? What are the things that I do in my day-to-day life? How much time do I have to play games? What am I looking for when I do play them? Are there any particular, you know, features of a game that excite me more than others? And doing those exercises help you figure out, one, your game design and the choices that you make, but they also help you figure out your marketing as well, because then you're like, okay, I should really promote this feature over this feature because this is the feature that most people will get excited about. And really spend time working on that branding, the logo, the look, the imagery, because, you know, yes, graphics aren't everything, and they're not, but ultimately, when it comes to looking at any storefront, whether it's Steam, whether it's Xbox, whether it's PlayStation, whether it's, you know, the Nintendo eShop, the first thing that you're going to see is a visual.
Right.
And so if that visual is not, yeah, exactly. If that visual is not good enough and it doesn't draw the attention and it doesn't get people interested, then it doesn't matter about anything else, because you fail to get them through the door. And not enough people, especially indies, because oftentimes marketing and branding and things like that are often an afterthought after development.
Yeah.
They don't spend enough time on that, and then oftentimes, you know, rush around and do a really poor job. But, you know, you should really be thinking about those type of things at the earliest possible stage, because it really does help inform your game choices, as well as, you know, helping make it ultimately a better game. Because if you are making a game to try and be commercially successful, then you should be trying to make that game as interesting for those players as possible and giving those players what they want. And, you know, that only leads to a better game and, you know, happy customers at the end of the day.
Yeah, I definitely agree. For those listening, Vicarious PR is helping all types of developers. So if you need any PR help, head over to their website, vicariouspr.com, where they have blogs and some resources as well and ways to contact them. And for those non-devs who are listening to this and just interested in finding out what's that next big indie game, or, you know, maybe even AAA game that they're promoting to find some cool new games, definitely check out their social media, something like their Twitter profile. I believe their Twitter is just at VicariousPR, which is super easy. So definitely go check them out there. Once again, Michael, thank you so much for joining today.
I appreciate it.